The treatment of genetic disorders. Now in this lecture we shall be, did you observe something in the past, over the past 2 days? We're kind of becoming very integrative, yeah, and we're trying to repeat things that you have already seen. Of course, there will be a few new things that you learn in every lecture. We hope there are a few new things, yeah. There's always no end to learning, okay. So what, no, there is, yeah, on after Thursday, there is no new lectures, okay? So we are coming close to the end. Okay, so treatment of genetic disorders. So what are the different kinds of management of genetic disorders? Yeah, so this, if you think about the different kinds of management of genetic disorders or the modes of management of genetic disorders, in many of the disorders that you have learned, typically in amino acid metabolism, you have learned that you can give higher doses of the coenzyme or the vitamin that is required as a coenzyme for that reaction. Okay? Now, in many of the disorders that you have studied, you can do dietary restriction of substrate. Yeah? Two disorders that come to my mind are PKU, maple syrup urine disease, galactosemia. So you have learned many examples where you can reduce the substrate. You can restrict the substrate in the diet. You have already learned about chemical diversion therapy, but we are just going to give it that name today, that is used in the urea cycle disorders. Protein or enzyme replacement therapy, which is quite expensive, but still we have developed it for many of the inborn errors of metabolism, for many of the disorders that we have studied in this module. Okay? Now, targeting signal transduction pathways. So we are not going to talk too much about both of these. You remember where did we study this? This was done in last term under cancer. So management of cancer. You remember? We looked at HER2 antibodies, that is Herceptin, and in Philadelphia positive chronic myeloid leukemia, imatinib was administered. So these are the two that are specifically for cancer chemotherapy. Epigenetic modifications, we have heard about this, and a classical example where you can use epigenetic modification as a mode of therapy is sickle cell anemia. We are just going to touch on that today. We'll look at briefly at the concept of gene therapy. We're not going to go into great details, but because there are so many obstacles associated with gene therapy. Finally, a small note on stem cell therapy, and in the end, we shall look at what's called as antisense therapy or RNA interference. Yeah? So this is what we shall be doing over the next 50 minutes or 45 minutes. So you have seen a wide variety of inborn errors of metabolism. Now in many of them, what you can do is give high doses of the vitamin, which is then converted into a coenzyme, so that at least some of the enzyme can bind to that coenzyme and you have more activity. In other words, there is improved clinical response in the patient. Okay? So you have to think about enzymes. So what has happened in these patients is the enzyme has a reduced binding affinity for the coenzyme. Yeah? So in such patients, administration of high doses of the coenzyme or the vitamin that forms that coenzyme can be useful. So we have taken the example of homocystinuria, which is caused by deficiency of cystathionine beta synthase, which requires pyridoxal phosphate. So you administer higher doses of vitamin B6, which is converted to pyridoxal phosphate, and now you have a little more activity of the enzyme than before. Okay? Now, if you think about PKU, phenylketonuria, there are two kinds of PKU. PKU1, where the enzyme deficiency is phenylalanine hydroxylase. Now, in patients with PKU1, the most common mode of management is to restrict phenylalanine in the diet. Now, also remember that in these patients, you may have to supplement tyrosine in the diet because there is no formation of tyrosine. In other words, tyrosine in these patients becomes kind of essential amino acid because there is less conversion of phenylalanine to tyrosine. Now, besides that, so that is what you're trying to do is reduce, restrict the substrate. Now, besides that, you can also give them higher doses of the coenzyme required, that is tetrahydrobiopterin. And there is a coenzyme available, and this is known as sapropterin, which is basically a modified tetrahydrobiopterin. Now, PKU2, on the other hand, is due to deficiency of the coenzyme or due to deficiency of this conversion of the tetrahydrobiopterin, the conversion of the tetrahydrobiopterin, or sometimes even synthesis of the biopterin. And the prognosis in PKU2 is much more worse, or it's more challenging to treat PKU2 because the brain is involved, and the blood-brain barrier kind of does not accept the sapropterin that is given to these patients. Yeah? So blood-brain barrier is the huge obstacle in management of patients with PKU2, where basically there is a problem with the coenzyme. Okay. Now, in the urea cycle disorder, you've seen that most patients with urea cycle disorder, remember, there is the manifestations is because of high blood ammonia levels. So high blood ammonia levels. Remember, ammonia is coming by the breakdown of protein. So in these patients, you want to reduce dietary protein. So low protein diet is typically advised in patients with urea cycle disorder. Again, you're trying to reduce the substrate, that is protein or amino acids in the diet. Also, in patients with urea cycle disorder, you want to minimize stress or starvation, because at these times, what happens is the body protein tends to be broken down. So you want to minimize the breakdown of, or minimize too much breakdown of body protein. That is, avoid stress and starvation or illness. Now, another mode of treatment. So basically what happens in patients with urea cycle defect is the ammonia is not being converted to urea, and the manifestations is because of too much ammonia, which affects the neurological function. So one of the modes of treatment is give what's called a sodium benzoate. So ammonia, remember, can be converted to glycine. Glycine is a non-essential amino acid, which combines with benzoate to be excreted as hippuric acid. So basically what you're trying to do is divert the ammonia to formation of glycine, which can then be a mode of loss for nitrogen or ammonia. So this is a classical example of diversion therapy, where ammonia is diverted to glycine and will be excreted as hippuric acid or hippurate. So you've already seen that under the urea cycle disorders. Now, protein replacement therapy, there are innumerable examples that we have done throughout the course. I'd like you all to go back to hemophilia A, where factor 8 replacement therapy is quite a effective mode of management. Okay, and synthesis of factor 8 by recombinant DNA technology has improved the prognosis in patients with hemophilia A. Okay, so that is about replacement therapy. So there are some animal models where gene therapy has been found to be successful, but we are going to go back to gene therapy in a little bit and see what are the basic obstacles for this mode of treatment. Now, sometimes when you use protein replacement therapy or enzyme replacement therapy, this protein is killed by the system because it is considered as non-self. In other words, there is an antigenic response or an immune response. So what we can do is, so imagine this is your protein or the enzyme that you want to replace. Tag it to a carbohydrate group, typically polyethylene glycol, which kind of shades it and protects it by degradation. So there are three important uses. One is the protein is not as rapidly degraded, so you increase the half-life of this enzyme or protein. You also prevent, the molecule becomes bigger, and as a result, the kidney cannot easily excrete it, so you're again improving the half-life, and the chance of an immune response can be reduced. Yeah? So basically what is done is you're trying to protect the protein that you want to replace, or the enzyme that you want to replace, with a PEG group or a polyethylene glycol group. Now, you've learnt about this disorder in the last term, that is autosomal recessive kind of severe combined immunodeficiency, where there is deficiency of the enzyme adenosine deaminase. Okay, this ARSKID is going to come back in immunology. Okay, the different modes of management. So look at the protein replacement therapy. So what you're basically trying to do is give the enzyme ADA, and you protect the enzyme by adding a PEG group. Yeah. So again, it improves the half-life of the enzyme. Okay. Now you've seen the example of Gaucher's disease. Now pegylation has been tried to improve the half-life of beta-glucocerebrosidase. That is the enzyme that is deficient in patients with Gaucher's disease. Besides that, addition of mannose to the protein or exposure of the mannose allows the lysosomes or the macrophages to now take up this enzyme into the lysosomes. In other words, there is improvement, there is symptomatic improvement in the patient. Now, one of the challenges with protein replacement therapy is it's quite expensive, and you have to repeatedly be giving this protein or the enzyme at repeated intervals so that you see clinical improvement, and it is quite expensive for treatment. Okay. Now this is going back to your cancer lectures that you did in the last term. There are two modes in cancer. One is the Philadelphia positive chronic myeloid leukemia. We have seen an inhibitor of tyrosine kinase, that is Gleevec or imatinib mesylate. Yeah. So this is going back to that lecture. HER2, especially in HER2 positive breast cancer, what you try to do is use an antibody against the HER2 receptor, and therefore there is less of signal transduction. In other words, less signal for cell division or improvement of cancer. So these are the two modes of therapy that you can use in cancer. And this refers to what we have done in the last term. So it's up to you to go back and make sure you understand what we are talking about here. Okay. Now, how many of you remember HBS? Most of you remember. In HBS, there is repeated episodes of sickling. Yeah. Now, to have symptomatic improvement in many patients with HBS, what is done is you increase the expression of the gamma globin. You remember that? You increase gamma globin expression. Long time no see. Yeah. So how do we increase gamma globin expression? Is typically you can increase the gene expression. So basically you can inhibit histone deacetylation. What is commonly used is the drug hydroxyurea, and that somehow increases gamma globin expression, and as a result there is more HbF. So in these patients with HBS, what happens is when there is no HbF or very low HbF, what happens is there is polymerization of the HBS to form sickle-shaped RBCs. Whereas once you increase the concentration of HbF, what happens is there is less tendency to sickle. Okay, so that is the basis of increasing. So what we're trying to do here is you're trying to epigenetically modify and try to increase a protein that is normally repressed. So gamma globin is normally not produced during adult life, but you're awakening the expression of gamma globin again so that you increase the content of HbF. Okay? And as a result, there is less episodes of sickling. Okay? Again, this is what you have done before. We just want you to go back and make sure you understand what we're talking about. Now, the next part of the lecture, we'll try to identify what is gene therapy. How many of you are interested actually in gene therapy? One person? Okay. Yeah. And there is a reason for that, you know, because it's you know, it received a lot of hype when we were med students, yeah, and we were so excited, wow, we can cure all diseases. But obviously, there are so many obstacles that have occurred in the development of proper gene therapy modes, yeah. So we'll try to understand what is gene therapy, and hopefully he will be able to come up with better, and we can explain this better to the entire class. For those of you who are very interested, can go back there to that website, and there is they have tried to explain what is the exact mode or what are the different approaches for gene therapy. Okay. So if you think about what is gene therapy, so basically what we're trying to do is you're trying to insert a normal gene. So we have talked about variety of single gene disorders. We're trying to insert the normal gene, and we have to assume, so once you insert the normal gene into the cell, you have to assume that this gene is going to be expressed and is going to produce what's called as the normal functional protein. So basically in gene therapy, you're trying to take the normal gene and put it into the cell of the individual to make sure there is expression or production of the normal protein. Yeah, it looks kind of the best treatment, because you're actually trying to target the actual defect in the patient. Yeah, that is, there was a defective gene initially, so now you're trying to replace it with a normal gene, so it looks like the best treatment available. However, it's not as simple as we explain it. Okay, we hope it was that simple. Now, it's universally agreed throughout the whole world that germline therapy is not acceptable. So don't do germline therapy. Yes, don't do germline therapy. What is acceptable is only somatic cell gene therapy. Okay, so you can't change the DNA of the future generation. That will seem like God, yeah? So you don't want to do that. Now, there are two modes of gene therapy. One is called as in vivo method versus ex vivo. Now, in the in vivo method, what you tend to do is, the cloned gene here is nothing but the normal gene. You insert the normal gene directly using a vector into the patient. That is the in vivo method. The other form is called as ex vivo, where you take the patient's cell. Now, in the lab, so you have the patient's cell. So what you do is transfer the normal gene into the patient's cell. Now, the next job is to select the cells which have this normal gene. And once you select the cells with the inserted gene or the cloned gene, you put it back into the patient. This is ex vivo gene therapy. So we shall be looking at both of these in a little more detail in the next part of the lecture. In vivo versus ex vivo gene therapy. Now, what disorders do you think are amenable for gene therapy? So, of course, the single gene defects will be the best targets, because only one gene is defective. So you just have to replace that mutant gene with a normal gene. Yeah? Now, however, note that a lot of gene therapy research has also been conducted for cancer, in which most of the time it is multiple gene defects. So it's not necessary that it be a single gene defect, but most of the time these are the most, these are kind of easier to do than multiple gene defects. You may also want to identify the gene, and you want to clone the gene in the functional form, that is the actual gene as well as the regulated subunits. And the affected tissue has to be accessible for the gene delivery. And cystic fibrosis is a classical example. Similarly, the bone marrow cells are good cells where you can, that is the affected tissue, where you take the bone marrow cells, and once you put it back into the patient, these bone marrow cells go back into the bone marrow. Yeah, so they're kind of neat for doing gene delivery. So what are the different disorders in which gene therapy has been tried? So we are going to explain SCID, that is adenosine deaminase, because that was the first disorder somewhere around 1990, the first disorder in which gene therapy was actually tried. Now, various other disorders have also been tried, and cystic fibrosis mutation of the CFTR gene has also been tried, and we are going to explain a little more about cystic fibrosis also. Okay? In many of the cancers, I think P53 we shall be explaining towards the end. Now, the next challenge is, so we have to be able to put the normal gene into the cell of the patient. Yeah. Now, you typically need what is called a delivery system or a vector. So this vector should be able to target the correct cell type, and it has to get it into quite a number of cells, and the gene has to be intact and then expressed. So if you think about the different delivery methods, viruses are said to be the experts at putting in gene into the cell. So viruses have been used to a large extent. Note that there are two kinds of viruses which you will be studying under microbiology. One is adeno versus retrovirus. Now, if you look at these two delivery methods, adenoviruses tend to put any genetic material out of the chromosome. So they kind of transfer gene out of the chromosome. In other words, the gene that you put into the cell remains extra chromosomal. So it remains out of the chromosome or extra chromosomal. Now, as a result, what happens is when you put in the normal gene, the cellular mechanism does not, or the nucleus of the cell does not like any genetic material to be out of the chromosome. So with time, what happens is if you have used an adenovirus, that gene that you have inserted can be destroyed by the cellular machinery. Yeah. So adenoviruses were not the best. So next we'll look at what's the importance of retroviruses. Now retroviruses have this unique capacity of putting in genetic material and they insert it into the genome. They can integrate it into the genome. Yeah. So retroviruses are kind of neat. However, you don't know where the retrovirus is going to put in that gene. And one of the major complications by using retrovirus as a vector was the gene was inserted into inappropriate places, and as a result, what happened was the tumor suppressor gene was inactivated or an oncogene was activated. In other words, one of the side effects of using retroviruses was the development of cancer in many patients in which retrovirus was used as a vector. However, the major advantage of using the retrovirus was that the gene was put into the chromosome, so it had a longer life. That means the DNA was not broken, or the gene that was added was not broken. Okay, and that is explained here. Now, remember, the viruses can inject the gene, but you don't want the virus to infect. So these are basically genetically engineered viruses that are only able to inject the gene but not cause no infection in the patient. Yeah? So you're using genetically modified viruses. Now the next method is liposomes. With liposomes is basically a phospholipid bilayer, and in that you put in the cloned gene or the normal gene, and you hope that the gene genetic material is transferred into the cell. Now note that there is no risk of infection or cancer, but the rate of delivery of the gene into the cell is kind of very low. Yeah, so liposomes they can be used, but they have their huge disadvantages. Now let's take the example of cystic fibrosis. So cystic fibrosis, the main organ that is affected is the respiratory epithelium. So the main cells that are affected are respiratory epithelium. So what was done is, this is an adenovirus, genetically engineered an adenovirus, and this line here indicates the normal CFTR gene. So the adenovirus infects the cell. You allow the adenovirus to infect into the cell, and it is extra chromosomal. After some time, it will start producing or expressing the protein. So the CFTR protein is produced in these epithelial cells. Now this is a classical example of using an aerosol which contains a modified adenovirus with the CFTR gene, an in vivo method, in vivo, where you're directly inserting the vector into the patient and allowing it to transfect or allowing it to transform the epithelial cells. Now, one of the biggest problems with this was that the lung epithelial cell is replaced every few days. So it has a short half-life, and as a result, repeated delivery is necessary. Now, besides that, since adenoviruses can affect the respiratory epithelium, so even if you have used a modified adenovirus, sometimes it resulted in what's called as immune response in the patient. Yeah, and that is one disadvantage of using adenovirus for cystic fibrosis. Yeah, so it is kind of filled with obstacles. Okay, and that is what I've explained just now. Okay, so you can go back and read it. So these are the different gene therapy events we have plotted till 2006. Of course, don't memorize this. but it began in 1990 and is continuing, kind of sporadic. Okay, but what I want you all to pay attention to is these three patients, where in one there was death because of immune response. The disorder that we are talking about is OTC deficiency, which is a defect in the urea cycle. Yeah, so the urea cycle defect, and as a result, this patient had high blood ammonia levels, but when he came to the hospital, he was kind of healthy. That means he did not have an episode of hyperammonemia, but he never left the hospital after the treatment. So with that, what happened is the gene therapist moved back. Yeah. So most likely what happened was there was an immune response to the adenovirus that was given to the patient. Okay. So this is one of the most frequent complications and one of the most important obstacles in gene therapy. So immune response. Now, if you look at the table back again, you will see that there were two more patients with cancer. So you treated for one disorder, but then a few years later, the patients came back with another disorder that you did not intend for them to have. So most likely what happened was retroviruses could put in the normal gene anywhere they want, and most likely what happened was a proto-oncogene was activated or a tumor suppressor gene was inactivated. Okay, so these are huge problems with gene therapy. Now, in the past few years, gene therapy has been reawakened again. Of course, the United States is kind of lagging, but in China, there is reports of head and neck cell squamous cell carcinoma. And so this is the patient before the treatment. What was then done is adenovirus with modified P53 protein or P53 gene. So these cells were allowed to infect the cancer cells, and as a result, the normal P53 protein was injected using the virus. And there was improvement in the cancer. In other words, kind of treatment. Yeah. So this is about Jendison, which uses P53. The gene is P53. And P53, remember, it controls the cell cycle. So the normal P53 protein was most likely produced in the cells that have been modified by the treatment. Now, so we talked about adenovirus and the viral delivery system. Now, in the European Union, there is the report of lipoprotein lipase gene therapy. And this has may be used for patients with the more common disorders, the metabolic syndrome, hyperlipoproteinemia, where there is defect in lipoprotein lipase, or even in patients with other disorders. Okay, but again, note that even though there is a lot of hype about it, there are too many obstacles to be able to achieve something of clinical interest. Now, for those of you who is very interested, last term we had like three or four people who are very interested. Now, we talked about the retroviruses. So better than that is the CRISPR-Cas9 technology, which acts like scissors. And you can exactly know where you want to cut the DNA and put in the normal gene. Okay, so this is a newer technology. It has been used in mouse models, and they even gave me this article. So people who are very interested can go back and review the importance of this for future of gene therapy. Okay, so I don't think this is the end of gene therapy, but rather the beginning. We just don't know where we are going with gene therapy. So this is kind of like where we are at present. Okay. So we talked about the in vivo versus ex vivo, and you understand the difference. In vivo is where the clone gene is added into the vector and directly given to the patient, whereas ex vivo is take out the patient cell, culture it, and return it back to the patient. This is typically used with cells of the bone marrow, and that was what was used for adenosine deaminase. Okay. Now, next we look at very briefly about what are the cells of the inner cell mass. Yeah, so if you reflect back on embryology, you know that these cells are called as the pluripotent stem cells, and they can actually give rise to any kind of tissue based on the respective stimulus. Yeah, so the stem cell therapy or the formation of the stem cells. So basically what you try to do in the generation of the stem cells is you take the patient cell. So this is the patient cell and you have modified it. Take the nucleus of the patient cell. So hopefully you have corrected the nucleus. And take the egg cell without the nucleus. So you still have the patient's nucleus, but you now have a cytosol from the egg cell. So most likely, there are some factors in the cytosol that allow this cell to now go back to the stem cell stage. In other words, you're doing a de-differentiation. So it's going back to the stem cell. You grow them and you form a blastocyst. And now you can use these cells. Remember, since you have the same nucleus, these cells are not rejected by the patient. Yeah? In other words, they are easily accepted by the patient. So you can use the appropriate stimulus for them to be differentiated into the specific cell type. Okay? So this is how you create an embryonic stem cell from a somatic cell in the patient, and you can use it. The extent that these stem cells can be used in therapy is kind of very vast, yeah? And it's kind of fascinating. So these were the two Nobel Prize winners for development of the stem cell technology. So basically what we're trying to say is the cytosol of the fertilized egg cell has some factors that allow de-differentiation and allow it to go back to the stem cell stage. So basically what you're trying to do is convert a differentiated cell or a somatic cell back to the stem cell stage. Okay, and that's by fusing it with the cytosol of the egg cell or a fertilized egg cell. Okay, so that is about the stem cell therapy or what's called as the pluripotent stem cells. Now, in the next part of the lecture, we shall look at what are the different RNA species in the cell. Now, if you go back and try to do a PubMed search or a Google Scholar search, you will find that this is kind of a very developing area, especially when we are talking about two kinds of RNA called as microRNA. One of them is microRNA. The other kind of RNA is small interfering RNA. Now, both of these RNA, so basically the siRNA are derived from the microRNA. And these regulate gene expression. So this is what we are going to look at in the next part of the lecture. What is the importance of microRNA and siRNA? And basically what you're trying to do is develop siRNA or develop oligonucleotides that act as interfering RNA. And this is the entire basis of what's called as antisense therapy. And that is what we shall be looking at in the next part of the lecture. Now, if you look at the microRNA, you've studied this last term. So microRNA basically will be converted or processed into what's called as siRNA. siRNA bind to the mRNA. They bind to the mRNA. So siRNA will bind to the mRNA. And they basically have two functions. They inhibit the translation of the mRNA. So they inhibit translation of the mRNA, that's called as translational silencing, or binding of the siRNA to the mRNA will facilitate degradation of the mRNA. In other words, so as a result of both of these processes, so there is going to be less of the mRNA available for translation. So there is going to be less of mRNA available for translation. So there is going to be destruction of the miRNA and silencing or no translation of this mRNA. So in a wide variety of cancers, you find that various miRNA can be up or down regulated. Okay? So basically, you're looking at two kinds of miRNA. So in some cancers, you find that there is too much production of the oncoprotein. And when you observe these cells, you find that there is too little miRNA. So there is reduced miRNA production for that oncoprotein mRNA. And as a result, what happens is there is too much production of the oncoprotein. So basically, in antisense therapy, what you're trying to do is, in these cells, you're going to put in exogenous miRNA, so that the oncoprotein mRNA bind to it and are no longer translated. So basically, you want to reduce the amount of oncoprotein formed. And for that, what you do is insert miRNA into these cells, and as a result, they will bind to these oncogenic mRNA, and there will be less production of the oncoprotein. Yeah? Now, if you look at the next slide, that is basically what we're trying to do. Again, note that this is still in the stage of the lab, and it's not yet come to too much clinical practice. However, there have been a few clinical trials with antisense oligonucleotides. Yeah? So this kind of therapy is called as antisense therapy, also called as RNA interference therapy. Now, in these cells, so these are a group of cancer cells which have overexpression of BCL2, which is an inhibitor of apoptosis or inhibitor of cell death. So there is too much production of BCL2. Now, what was done is you use siRNA for this mRNA, for the BCL2 mRNA. And as a result, you found there is improvement of cancer. In other words, there is more cell death or apoptosis in these cells. So basically what was done is add antisense nucleotides for this inhibitor of apoptosis, that is BCL2. So there is too much of BCL2 mRNA in the cancer cells. So what you do is add an oligonucleotide that binds to the mRNA of BCL2. And as a result, what was observed was there was less translation of BCL2. In other words, there is going to be more cell death or apoptosis. So this is the basis of antisense therapy or RNA interference therapy. Okay? But note that this is still in the lab stage. Okay? Of course, a few of them have been tried, but not. We're still lagging behind. So there are two questions that we would like you all to answer. You're tired. Okay. You're forgiven. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were all of you able to do the quiz 2? Yes? Okay. Quiz 3 is also up. Make sure you do it before the deadline. Quiz 4 and 5 will be up this week on Thursday. Okay? 4 will be mainly topics concentrating on what we did this week and maybe last week. And 5 is kind of integrative, the whole thing. Okay, so we have questions from anatomy, physio, histo, and biochem. Okay, we'll put up announcements. We just hope the internet works. Otherwise, you have an open invitation to come to my house. Yeah, as we discuss. Yeah? Okay, let's see what you answer. Okay, so what in a newborn infant identified with PKU, which mode of therapy has been tried? You supplement the product for the enzyme. Okay, just read it carefully. You would like to supplement the product, not the substrate. You would like to avoid the substrate for the enzyme. You want to give the product for the enzyme. That is, you have to substitute tyrosine in the diet. What coenzyme do you use? Tetrahydrobiopterin or saproterin? Derepression of the PAH gene has not been tried. Rather, antibodies to PAH. No, we didn't explain that. Okay. Okay. This one is tough. So if you get this, I'll give you a high five. Yeah. A free point. Yeah. No. High five. Only high five. Okay, so have you answered? So what are the different kinds of treatment that you can use? Yeah, this is kind of a difficult question. You don't want to insert the oncogene. Rather, you would like to insert a tumor suppressor gene. Okay, so insertion of the oncogene would just make it worse. Okay, so that is not the mode of therapy. Antisense oligonucleotides, remember, are siRNA or miRNA, which can bind to the mRNA for that oncogene. For example, we use the example of BCL2, and as a result, what happened was there was reduction in expression of that mRNA or of that oncogene. So that would be the answer. What happens when you demethylate the promoter? When you methylate a promoter, what happens? It becomes silenced or imprinted. Whereas when you demethylate, there is going to be overactivity of that promoter. In other words, there is too much production of the oncoprotein. Pegylation of the oncoprotein, no. You don't want to protect that oncoprotein. Yeah. So pegylation is mainly used for enzyme replacement therapy. Okay. What happens when you use a histone deacetylase inhibitor? So histone will now have acetyl groups, and as a result, the DNA will be unwound, and there is more expression, overexpression. So you don't want overexpression. What I was trying to ask is, what is antisense therapy, or basically what we did towards the end of the lecture? Yeah, basically antisense therapy, or miRNA, or interference, RNA interference therapy. Okay. So I think with that we completed this lecture for the day. So you can take a little longer break, maybe have breakfast and come back. So do you want to, yeah, and you have one more lecture today at 10 o'clock. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.